This is episode number 39 with Director of Data Science at VSCO, Ruben Kogel. Welcome to the Super Data Science Podcast. My name is Kirill Eremenko, data science coach and lifestyle entrepreneur. And each week we bring you inspiring people and ideas to help you build your successful career in data science. Thanks for being here today, and now let's make the complex simple. Hello everyone, today we've got the legend Ruben Kogel returning for podcast session number 2. Ruben was my very first guest on the Super Data Science show back in August/September 2016. And since then, it's been about 6 months. And guess what? His podcast, his session has been downloaded and listened to 10,000 times. Over 10,000 people have listened to his session. How incredible is that? Very excited about all of the knowledge that people gain from that one episode that we recorded back in 2016. So it's going to be very exciting to catch up today again. And we had a fantastic chat. We talked about many different things, and specifically, here's a couple of them. So Ruben joined the team at VSCO, and he built up a data science capability from the ground up. And he mentions the 3 points that he focused on when building the capability. So this will be very valuable to those of you who are looking forward for towards more senior roles where you'll be in charge of some elements of the data science inside the organization. Also, we talk in detail about what Ruben is looking for in people who he is hiring for VSCO. Ruben right now is hiring data scientists for a team at VSCO, and he explains the actual skill sets and mentalities that he's looking for in people he's hiring. And apart from all of that, of course, there's lots and lots of other value that we've discussed on this podcast. And I just want to reiterate again, Ruben is hiring. So at the very end of the podcast, we speak about how you can get an opportunity. And VSCO is actually in Oakland, San Francisco. And I know that a lot of you guys are in the San Francisco Bay Area, and a huge number of you are in California. So if you're interested in a data science position at a company with an amazing culture with Ruben as your mentor, this is an opportunity to die for. So if you're interested in that, if you're open to new opportunities, even if you're not, I would highly recommend checking out their job description. You can get it at, if you go to Ruben's LinkedIn or the show notes, you'll be able to see the link to it. But in short, it's bit.ly, so bit.ly/VSCO, so VSCO, and then small letters, data job. So definitely check that out. I think that there's going to be so much interest in this opportunity. It's going to be first come, first serve basis. Definitely make sure to jump on top of this. And on that note, without further ado, I bring to you the legend, Ruben Kogel, Director of Data Science at VSCO. Welcome everybody to the Super Data Science Podcast. And today, by popular demand, I have our favorite guest, Ruben Kogel, back on the show. Hi, Ruben. How are you today?
I'm doing great. It's great to be back. Thank you for having me again.
Awesome. What an intro, right?
Yeah.
And your podcast, 10,000 views. It's like mind-blowing. 10,000 downloads all over the world. People listening, watching. And how do you feel about that?
I'm kind of shocked. I almost think like it's not real.
Yeah.
It's just like you and I recording this podcast just a few months ago. So it's kind of weird thinking that it had that reach. But it's really great and amazing. I think it is also a testament to how good a job you did at marketing the podcast and reaching out to your audience. So really great.
Thanks, man. Thanks. But the thing that I think is you didn't tell me before the previous podcast, but you were actually a radio host yourself. And when you gave me a little hint about it afterwards, and I looked you up, and you, everybody listening, right away go and run and check out Ruben's old podcast, which was called All That Swing, right?
Yeah, All That Swing. Yeah, it was a short-lived podcast.
But like I listened to it, I couldn't stop listening. It's like, it's so fun. You mix in the music and so on. And no wonder you know, that podcast turned out well, because like it was my first session and yet you had all this experience. So it's a testament to you. You drove it home, man.
Thanks. You want to hear a funny story? So when I did this podcast, I had like zero experience doing a radio show, a podcast. And I was really doing it out of the basement in some radio somewhere. And I didn't think anyone was listening to it. And one day someone, you know, calls in, and we had like this old phone like ringing. And so you had to like wrangle and get the phone. And the person's like, hey, I really like the piece of music you just played. I like the podcast, but can you stop saying in between every sentence?
Really?
And it's the kind of thing you don't realize when you talk, I guess, like on the radio and a podcast. But all those fillers, they are very, very visible, and people can hear them on the other end.
Yeah, and so how did you get rid of them?
I don't think I did.
okay, gotcha. Took that feedback on board. Totally took it on board.
You know, I did a lot of editing. That's what I did.
Yeah, I know what you say. Oh, the editing, yeah. Like, I remember the days. It's like probably a good idea. When you're sitting there editing and you're thinking, probably it's a good idea to actually improve my skills so I spend less time editing.
Exactly. Yes. Sounds like you had that experience.
Yeah. It's totally. And it's good in terms of like even for data science, in terms of presentation later on when you're talking to people and presenting like data stuff, like any kind of public speaking, whether it's podcasts or anything else, I think it's a good experience.
Yeah, totally.
All right. Well, so speaking of data science, after the last podcast, it was very interesting. You were at Udemy and we recorded the podcast, and before I could release it, you had already left Udemy. So I had to put like a little disclaimer in the page that actually Ruben is no longer with Udemy. And that's just a testament to how popular data science, you know, valuable data sciences are. So tell us a bit about where you went and what have you been up to for the past 6 months?
Yeah. So I've, shortly after recording our podcast, I accepted a position at VSCO. And VSCO is a platform or mobile app for editing. It's very popular amongst people who post photos on Instagram. They use it to edit photos because it has like a really nice collection of like presets and editing tools. But it's more than that. It's also a community of expression. We have a lot of professional or semi-professional photographers posting photos on VSCO, discovering other people. And it's really a great community of photographers that we are building. And so I actually knew the tool and the app from doing some casual photography. And I was really attracted to the challenge of starting a new data team and really setting up, building the data function at VSCO, not just pulling data and really running analysis, but actually thinking around what kind of data do we need? How do we structure the data? What is the best way to look at it? How can I have the most impact on the product decision, on the strategy of the company? So it was a very interesting challenge, and it's been a very interesting challenge.
Oh, that's really cool. So like building it from the ground up, when you come in and there is like pretty much zero or a little bit, but you have full flexibility, full control. Is that right?
Yeah. So there was already data and tools in place, but what was missing is a sense of direction. And also we were at a crossroad where we were using too many vendors, too many tools. Everything was competing. People were looking at different dashboards, different vendors to get their information. And we just needed to rationalize a little bit how we were looking at things. And also we needed to put in place a structure that would be scalable with the audience and the future of the app. So even though there were a lot of tools and the great things that had been put in place, when I came in, I had this mandate to actually take a look at everything, at all the vendors, all the tools, all the data that we had, and decide which one we kept, which one we got rid of, how we would structure the data, and what would be our, you know, 2-3 year strategy for collecting, storing, and utilizing data.
Okay, that's really cool. And so, how did you go about that challenge? What was your thinking process?
So the way I went about it was, I talked to a lot of people. I set about to reach out or ask people to connect me with other people who worked at similar companies that had faced similar challenges, and started just talking to them. And in the process of talking with them, some themes started to emerge and some tools, and you know, I started to form some opinions about what was better than other solutions. So to give you like more concrete examples, I spoke with head of data engineering at Slack, head of data analytics at Instacart, people at Pandora, people at Twitter, started reading also a lot of blog posts, and it helped me get my thoughts around, you know, do we need to go with like a full-on data lake, put everything in Hadoop, and then, you know, like use Hive or Pig to look at the data and build dashboards on top of it? Should we use a solution like Tableau, which seems to be popular with, you know, larger organizations? Should we maybe use Redshift? Should we go into Google BigQuery? So all those questions came, and I had to sort of like organize, like, okay, why do we need to have those different solutions? What are the needs that are serving? And what is the best architecture that will let us address all of the needs that is both cost effective, but also scalable?
Mm-hmm. Okay, wow, that sounds like a really cool thing. And yeah, looking forward to digging into that right now, because I think after a lot of the podcast sessions that we've had on Super Data Science, people have slowly started to build up a good overview, understanding of all the tools that exist out there and all of the types of data science work that exist. And this would be, I think this could be like a good summary of how to put it all together. So like you spoke to all those people, you found out some, you know, what they kind of do, what kind of tools they use in that, and what their strategic directions are. And how did you then assess your situation and what is relevant to you, and then take those pieces of advice and implement them in your organization?
Yeah, it's a good question. The other piece that I sort of only alluded to was that I had to look at the needs in my organization and the fact that I was a very small data team. You know, I was basically a data team of one. So it was going to be impossible to provide the entire organization with ongoing analysis. I had to find a solution that was more scalable. And what I realized is for companies like us that have a mobile app or have like a platform that is consumer facing, a lot of the analysis comes down to recording events, recording taps, clicks, people going from one screen to the next, and counting, you know, how many people did a particular action in a particular week in the US versus not the US, on iOS, Android, etc. And for this type of analysis, there were already standalone solutions that existed and that were doing a fairly good job at it, and also enabled anyone in the company to look at the data without being an expert in SQL. In fact, without knowing SQL at all. And so I realized that there were really different needs in the company. There was this need for especially product people and designers, engineers, to have a quick look at the data, knowing over time, like how many people have published a photo, how many people have republished a photo, you know, dice it maybe by country, operating system, and having that tool that let them explore the data very quickly and draw time series was extremely valuable. And if we were to rebuild that tool from the ground up, it would take enormous effort and resources, and we wouldn't even be able to match the kind of like simplicity and latency that this tool offered. So clearly that there was a need here that was at the moment filled by a tool called Mixpanel. And we can talk more about like Mixpanel and alternatives, but there was this need that had been identified specifically for product engineer people. There was a second need around creating dashboards and reporting tools that were very clean and that sort of like conveyed a sense of truth, because you come into these organizations and people have been looking at data from different ways and it's not normalized. And so the CEO might be seeing something, the COO will see something else, the analyst will see something else entirely. And so having a place where people can agree, like, this is the truth, this is what's happening on our app with our audience, was extremely important. So that's that talks to the sort of like dashboard reporting piece. And the third part was around having a place that let analysts and data scientists do deeper analysis. That is the concept of a data warehouse. That's the concept of you put all of your data in one place, all the data is cleaned up, is verified, and that let people who manipulate SQL do deeper analysis, do maybe some clustering or things that are deeper than just doing a time series or reporting. So once I had identified the three needs, the product analytics, sort of like product event analytics on one hand, dashboarding, and deeper data analysis, I think it was a matter of sort of choosing the right technology and the right tools, you know, making sure it was both cost effective and scalable.
Yeah, wow, that's a really cool overview. So you started off by kind of like, I like what you said, that you need to, in an organization like this, you need to really think about how you're collecting the data. You need to set up the right data points and like event and for event analytics or for other things that you want to know what's been happening in, with your app, how are people interacting with it. So you set up those data points, and then you also look at the different needs in your company. And so you got you spoke about three, that you've got the product engineers, you've got the dashboards, and you've got the deeper analytics for the
Analysts.
Yeah. So is it like many different people, or does everybody have access to all of the data, and they like, is it one team predominantly working on all of these things? Or for instance, like product engineers, I understand they would have their own access, but for instance, dashboards and deeper analytics, is that one team? Is that your team working on it, or you have separate teams for each one of these three points that you identified?
So in terms of building those tools and those like data access, it's actually different processes. The product analytics suite, so we use Mixpanel. And Mixpanel basically hooks up to your app, to your mobile app, and you just have to set up a hook for them, and they automatically download all of the event, clean it up, augment it with location, add in like some anonymous ID, unique ID, and put it in a very high performance database, and put a user interface on top of it that let anyone, you know, sort of like ask questions without writing in SQL. So in that particular case, we are buying a service from this vendor. It's a very high performance service. And you'd be amazed, like running a query on billions of rows typically take like a second or two.
No way.
So they're really, yeah, it's a very, very optimized database. They actually run it directly in C. It's not even SQL, it's not Java, it's like directly in C when you enter some command. So it's really optimized both for data reliability and data performance.
Okay, fantastic. Like how many users do you have for, so that we know what numbers we're talking about here?
On a monthly basis, we have an audience of about 40 million people worldwide.
Wow.
And we have billion of events flowing every day. And because we like to instrument everything, we will record anytime someone goes on one screen, tap on a button, maybe, you know, do like a quick view on an image, republish the image, do an editing, what kind of editing they did, what was the parameters, the sliders and everything. So we have like billions and billions of events flowing. And so in order to manipulate that, you need a very high performance data pipeline and database system. And so Mixpanel deals with all of that as a service. We don't have to worry about any of it as long as the events are defined by our engineering team in the app. So they hard code the events. As long as that happens, Mixpanel can collect all of it at the end of the app. They use an SDK and they organize, clean up everything and make it accessible.
Gotcha. That's very interesting that you mentioned how you collect all the data. And sometimes I hear comments from data scientists that there's too much data. There's too much data in the world, in their organization, and they're getting overwhelmed with it. And it's like, to be fair, not all data is useful. You can't extract information. You can't get insights from every single piece of data that you have. Most of the time, you have to be very selective, and only some of the data is going to tell you some stories. So what is your view? Like, Is it efficient for you guys to collect all this data and then like go through it and actually pick out only the important stuff? Or would you say for somebody else, would you recommend to instead just collect the data that is actually necessary? Like, why did you guys take this approach of collecting absolutely everything?
There are two reasons to collecting all of the events we do. And by the way, we don't collect absolutely everything. There are things that we don't collect, but we do err on the side of collecting more than less. So there are two reasons to that. One is oftentimes you have product managers that are launching features and they are interested in understanding how users interact with a particular feature. So to give you an example, let's say that we just launched a subscription product, and so we added a little tile on our app so that people can click on it, they get brought into the store, and then into the store they can browse different products, including a subscription. And so we are interested in following exactly what people are doing. So we want to know how many people saw the tile, clicked on it, got into the store, viewed the product that is a subscription, and then eventually purchased it. Because once you have that all, that entire view, you can start optimizing the flow. You can start finding maybe there's a problem somewhere. That's why your conversions are not good. So it is important that you really have access to all of the data so you know exactly what's going on and you know exactly how to optimize your app to maximize engagement and revenue. That being said, you may not need to record everything at all time. There are events that are only important to record for a certain period of time when you're trying to optimize things. And after that, you can stop recording them. But it's easier to over-instrument than under-instrument, because what's costly is not the instrumentation itself. What's costly is then the storage and parsing through the data. But the storage itself, you can make a decision later on of like, this data we are keeping and this data we are not keeping. And for that, and I think that's where the data scientists come in, because they know, or they have an intuition of what is important, what isn't important, and they can parse the data and sort of like, yeah, separate the two.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Very, very, very cool. And that's some good advice, and like just record as much as you can and then remove some of it. So can you walk us through like a recent example out of what you can disclose of how you went about like a project? Like, I think in a situation like this with all this data, it's very important to ask the right questions, right? If you have all so much data and then you don't know exactly which question you're asking, you can get very lost. So can you walk us through a project and start off by how the person or whoever was requesting this project, how you guys went together about asking the right questions and then solving it?
Sure. So a project that I completed recently was looking at people who converted for a subscription. And so there was a general question of who are the people who are buying subscriptions, and are they behaving differently after buying a subscription than they were beforehand? And the question came to me exactly this way, so like very general, and it was on me to start engaging the conversation and start specifying like, okay, what exactly do we mean by, you know, who are those people, why are we interested in this question? So I went back to it was a question that came from one of our investors and that, you know, got transmitted through our CEO. And basically, I was trying to understand what exactly they were trying to get out of it to help me orient the analysis. And, you know, quickly it became clear that the question was really a marketing question. We have all these millions of users that are potential buyers, but we know they are not all likely to purchase. So we'd like to know who's more likely to purchase, because that two things. One, that'll tell us what is the size of the opportunity. And two, that'll tell us who should we market this product to be more effective in our messaging and being more effective with our marketing dollars. So once that was clarified,
Sorry if I could interrupt here. What were the other options? That it's a marketing question. What were the other options that it could have been? So just we were up to speed. What you were pondering, what decisions you were making?
I think it could have been, you know, we just want to know, generally speaking, what does those people look like in terms of maybe their behaviors in the app? Or it could have been a question of what do those people look like in and of itself, just like a descriptive questions. You know, we have all these people buying. Tell us a little bit more about them. But instead, I took it as a comparative questions. Like, we have those people buying in. What makes them different from the other people?
Oh, okay,
and what
gotcha.
Make them more likely to buy?
So a comparative question, as in an absolute question. For instance, you could have kind of like when you were saying that, it came to mind. Like, you could have been asked that question to identify what they look like, because not because you want to sell to them, but because once they are in there, you want to better service them. You want to, you know, like maybe identify which products they like once they're in the subscription membership. But instead, this indeed, as you say, is a marketing question. So two different types of questions.
Yeah, exactly.
Gotcha. Sorry, I interrupted you there.
Yeah, no. So once that was clarified, I think it became fairly straightforward, because I know there are only a limited number of actions that can predict that someone is more engaged and is more likely to purchase the subscription. And all I did really was to collect all of those actions into one, you know, big tables, and then run some sort of analysis. It was not even like a fancy statistical analysis. It was just a propensity analysis. So what I did is, like, you know, I said to myself, well, you know, the things that are predictive of whether someone will buy a subscription probably are whether they've purchased something in the past and how much of it they have. Have they been active in the last 30 days, and how active have they been? What country they're in, because that might affect their purchasing power, whether they are iOS or Android. So the list is really not that long. And then once you have all of that, it's really a matter of doing the right comparison. What I find was the most challenging piece of the analysis was not collecting the data or knowing which event to look at, but more doing like an apple-to-apple comparison. Because, for example, you might have a group of people who purchased the subscription in February. But out of that group, there are people who sign up to VSCO in February. So they have no history before February. You also have, you know, people who were completely inactive in the 30 days prior and somehow came back to VSCO because they saw an ad on whatever, like Facebook or Google. So like they randomly came back. And so you had to be very careful, because you can't compare the people who just signed up to February and bought a subscription with, I don't know, people who were active in January and didn't buy the subscription. So I think it's important to establish the right comparison here, which in this case was, let's take a segment of people who were active in the 30 days prior to, you know, February, and let's look at the people who did purchase and the people who did not purchase. Because then we have like a fixed base of the people who did that same thing. They looked exactly the same in January, but somehow one portion of them did purchase and one portion of them did not purchase. So establishing that like baseline is very important. And once you have that, it makes it a lot easier to compare the two groups.
Yeah, very cool. Love it. And you mentioned you did some propensity modeling on that. Why did you use propensity modeling over logistic regression or other types of classification techniques?
Because I think I didn't want to overwhelm our team with, I think, unnecessary complexity. I didn't think that the goal here was to predict, to have like one formula that would predict the probability of someone buying. I thought the more important was to surface trends and surface propensity according to different dimensions. So to be specific, you know, the kind of thing that we looked at is, you know, is the fact that you are on iOS makes you more likely to buy a subscription? And if yes, by how much? It doesn't matter that you're on iOS and you live in Australia and maybe you've used like three paid presets in the last 30 days, altogether increase, give you a likelihood of like whatever, like 30% or whatever it is. What matters is on each individual dimension, how much more likely you are to convert, because then we can like start narrowing down our marketing effort to those people. And we can also separate out the effects of all these different variables. So in a way, it's a much more natural and clear analysis to communicate to, you know, the marketing manager rather than coming up with like a long regression, which is a regression formula at the end.
Yeah, got it. And that's been a very interesting kind of trend that I've seen in this podcast, that a lot of the time people like yourself who have the skills, who have the access to the tools and methodologies, you choose to sometimes, not always, but sometimes to use a simpler approach simply because you have a further agenda after your analysis is complete, that, you know, you're not just delivering like a consultant a report. You're part of a team. You're building something. You want the company to succeed. You want the marketing manager to understand what's going on rather than having this convoluted formula, which might add an extra 10 or, you know, like 2% accuracy. But overall, it's not going to add that much value because they don't understand how to use it properly.
Exactly. I think here the key is like you want your recommendation to be actionable. You want people to understand what the analysis says and to be actionable. And so telling someone that being in the U.S. Gives you like a 50% lift over other people to convert, or having purchased a paid preset in the last 30 days give you whatever, like a 60% lift, that is much more clear and actionable than saying, you know, like the overall probability is blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, gotcha. And very interesting example. Thanks for that. And the other thing I wanted to ask you, really pick your brain on, being in your position, like as we discussed at the start of just before the podcast, that you are a director of data science, but a lot of the stuff that you're doing is also strategic. It's also which databases systems are we going to implement, who's going to have access to what, and so on. So like you're performing the role of the chief technology officer in combination with the director of data science, as I understand it. And a big part of that is spreading the culture of data across the organization. And that's something that I've personally faced in different roles I've been in. And it's often tough to get that culture, that whole appreciation across to people so that they become data advocates, that they help you out, that they look for these things in their own roles, how they can apply data and so on. So how have you been dealing with that? What kind of challenges and maybe the opposite, what kind of wins have you had? What challenges have you faced? What wins have you had in the space of data culture in your organization?
Yeah, no, it's a good question because I think you touched on something that's much more practical than running a machine learning algorithm or a regression. It's like, how do you have an impact on your organization and how can you be effective? And I would say that, you know, generally speaking, people are, you know, open-minded and everybody wants to be data-driven. The problem is that sometimes data is not accessible, or it's too complicated, or people don't have the time or patience to figure out exactly what's going on. And so my role as head of data at VSCO is to sit down with people and make sure that, one, they have access to the data that they need, but also that when they are trying to make decision, and they always want to make a data-driven decision, but when they are making that decision, that they are looking at the right data, they're looking at it the right way, and they understand the trade-off of the data, and they understand like, the limitation of what the data can say. So to give you like a concrete example, we actually have a weekly meeting between my team and the product team where it's kind of like a freewheeling meeting, but more often than not, we talk about some of the analysis that I came up with, or we talk about some of the A/B tests that the PMs run. And it's actually a forum where I get a chance to educate the team on how to interpret data, how to interpret the results of an A/B test, and what the data says and what the data doesn't say. So it's been really the source of like great conversations. In particular, we've had like great conversations around how to interpret the results of an A/B test, what is significant, what is not significant, whether, you know, 1 week of data is sufficient. Should we look at just one metric? Should we look at more metrics and retention, et cetera? So it's been, I think the key here is really having an ongoing conversation and trying to serve the needs of the people who are making decisions and are trying to use data to make decisions.
Yeah, that's great. I think that's a it's a very valuable thing as well, that training up the staff and having that opportunity. It's good that they're very open to meeting up with you on a weekly basis and having these discussions, because that's the first step for people to be open with that. And what's your vision for that? What's your vision for spreading the data culture in the organization? I know you're still early days, still just 6 months there, but say in 2-3 years, how would you like to see every employee in the company? What level would you like them to be able to interact with data?
Yeah, I think there are already tools in place that let people access the data. And we talked about Mixpanel. We also have a dashboarding tool that let people see the key metrics and play with the key metrics a little bit. I think the key is that I want to be able to automatically answer, let's say, 90 or 95% of people's general questions. I think the role of the data team is not to do data pools and do a SQL query to find out the number of users who did that or the number of people who've purchased in China or South Korea in the last month. All of this should be answered automatically with self-serve analytics, something that we talked about in our previous podcast. But really, there's that. The second part is also that people who make decisions around data, product managers, I want to make sure that we have a very solid framework for setting up and analyzing A/B tests. So that means that basically means we have a playbook of these are the rules of how you design A/B tests, how many people you put in each bucket. Do not touch your A/B test for 2 weeks so that you don't mess up the buckets. And then when you analyze the results, I want you to go into this dashboard and to look not just at your particular funnel, but look at a bunch of other metrics and check that they are not affected, or check that the retention is also there. Basically, a combination of making sure everybody is has access to the tools, is comfortable using the tools, so that goes through training, but also setting up for more specific use case funnel analysis, A/B test analysis, setting up a playbook and making sure that the people who are going to own those features know how to run the analysis. Because again, at the end of the day, I think even doing an A/B test analysis, that is something it's pretty programmatic. It's pretty, you can follow a set of rules. I don't have to redo the analysis every time. I don't have to have my team redo the analysis. I can just set up the dashboard, set up the guidelines, and have the owner of the product do the analysis on their own. So that's kind of my vision for how I would educate the team around the use of data and how I would empower the team to use data.
Okay. Yeah, that's pretty cool. What it reminds me of is, I like how there's a company in San Diego called Digital Marketer. So it's a large company for marketers and how to do online ads and stuff like that. But I like how they've got it set up. They've got a set of onboarding training, which actually they have been so successful within the company that they've made them available. You can subscribe to them, and in Super Data Science we use some of their trainings as well. You can subscribe to them and your staff can go through this training, and some of them are A/B tests and statistical analysis for marketers, of course, but at the same time it's pretty valuable, and I like the structured approach. And that kind of reminded me of when you said that a lot of it is to do with education. So when somebody new starts, or maybe once in a while, employees can go through these trainings and educate themselves on how to use these tools properly. That's very important. And the other thing I wanted to ask you, while we're on this topic, you've touched on A/B tests several times. Maybe you can educate us a little bit. What is your rule of thumb for an A/B test? What should the sample size be for an A/B test to most likely be statistically significant? Do you have a rule of thumb?
I mean, I think obviously it really depends on the size of your audience, the number of people who will see the particular thing that you're changing, and the conversion rate. So there are pretty standard calculators online that will tell you, you need that many people. Typically in our case, we need 5 to 10,000 people in each bucket, because we are interested in looking at this meaningful changes. One of the things that I warn people against is running a lot of A/B tests, just trying to optimize like the button or an image, and trying to see like small changes. Because I don't think that's the right way of running an A/B test. Because one is you will always have false positives, even when you run a test at like, you know, 95% confidence. It still means like 1 in 20 you'll have a false positive. And so if you run 5 tests in parallel, then all of a sudden you have a higher, much higher chance of just hitting a false positive. And second is because I think it's important to, even when you run the A/B test, you have a hypothesis behind. You're not just testing random combinations of things. You are testing a hypothesis. You're saying, I'm going to change the flow, the conversion flow on my store to, you know, from A to B, or I'm gonna make the shopping cart much more prominent, and therefore I think that people will see it, and I think people will convert at a higher rate. So it's important to test the hypothesis, and it's also important to hold yourself accountable to a big change. You don't want to optimize things and move like conversion from 10 to 10.1%. You want something that will move it meaningfully, that will move it from 10 to 11 or 12 or 15%. And so that's, I think, the right way of running A/B tests. And when you do that, it also means that you don't need as big of a sample, because you're really looking for big changes. And if you don't see a big change, then maybe it's not that meaningful of a test.
Yeah, gotcha. Last time you were on the podcast, you recommended a book by Nate Silver, The Signal and Noise. I actually have it here. Yeah, and I'm reading it, and I know I probably should have read it years ago. It's so good, but it talks to a bit about what you mentioned now, that your tests, and I want to reiterate this point for our listeners, that your tests that you're running, they have to be meaningful. They have to be like, they have to make sense, right? Because in the book, Nate Silver does a good comparison of Bayes, who was, I think it was like 18th century or something like that, and Fisher, who was 20th century. And Bayesian probabilities and Bayesian inference, or maybe Fisher was like 19th century, but Bayesian probabilities and inference versus Fisherian, as they call it, probability and inference, and how like Fisher didn't really like Bayes for this concept. Like a lot of the stuff that we do in, especially in this just pure statistical testing, is actually developed from the concept of the what were we talking about, the
frequentist statistics.
Yeah, the frequentist statistics, exactly. And therefore we forget sometimes about the whole purpose, the whole idea behind the test. And he has a good example of in the book that if you use this approach of just like standard A/B testing, standard frequentist statistics, you can kind of prove that frogs can predict earthquakes, right? Just because there's some correlation there, but correlation doesn't always imply causation. So that's a good example of you have to think about that what you're testing makes sense. There's no point even in thinking about testing that frogs can predict earthquakes, because it just doesn't make sense. And even if you have a positive result, it's most likely going to be a false positive, you know, in advance. And I think that kind of stands to the point which you raised.
Yeah, totally. I totally subscribe to that. And I think it's important to be thoughtful when you set up experiments and when you analyze A/B test.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. All right. So moving on to my next area of discussion, your LinkedIn says you're hiring, and it seems like this is a credo that you carry through life. Wherever you go, you're hiring data scientists. I don't think we talked much about this last time, but this will really benefit people listening. And what are the skills? What are the qualities? Not just skills. What are the qualities that you want in your ideal candidate when you're hiring data scientists?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think there's a lot of misconception about what it takes to be a data scientist and how do you get hired. There are a couple of things that are important. And I think oftentimes people, the first thing is sort of like a general business intuition and communication skills. I think it's easy for people to get mired into complicated analysis, trying to, you know, spin up a Python and run like this crazy regression, maybe a boosted trees or whatever, but not being able to one, bring in like the right ingredients in the analysis, and two, explain what comes out of the analysis. So let me be a bit more specific. Let's say that you were tasked with predicting churn of your customer base. I think the probably one of the most important piece of this work would be to come up with the right variables, the right features in your analysis that are most likely to predict churn. And so in order to do that, you really need some business sense and intuition. You need some data intuition so that you construct the right features in your analysis. And when you have the right feature, usually like that's 80% of the job. Then it doesn't matter what technique you use to, it almost doesn't matter what technique you use to identify the most important features. Having them in your data set is the most important part, and they will always come out at the end. And so that's very, very critical. And the second thing is then being able to explain to a lay audience what does the result of the analysis means. Because again, if you're just writing a technical note that no one will read, then you have zero impact in your company. You want to be able to talk to the CEO, to the product manager, to the marketing manager, and tell them like, I looked at the data, and the data says that these are the five things that predict churn, and these are like the rank order of the thing that predict churn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. Break it down to them and make it digestible, right? Accessible, the insights, and actionable, as you say.
Exactly. So that basically speaks to both a business intuition and communication skills. I think what's important on top of that is also structured thinking, the ability to, you know, what you just say, like take a problem that is very vague and complex and breaking down into like more manageable pieces and coming up with a data question that corresponds to that business problem. So earlier we talked about subscription, and the business question was like, what do our, you know, people who subscribe look like? And you have to be able to turn this into an actual data question that will yield meaningful answer. And the data question is like, oh, let's look at all the people that were active in the month of January. Let's look at their activity in terms of like, you know, editing and purchasing, et cetera. And let's look at like what make them more likely to convert than not. So this ability to like critical thinking, structured thinking is also extremely important. And all of that has nothing to do with skills and knowledge. It's really more about a way of thinking and grappling with problems. Now, obviously, there are like important skills and knowledge. You know, number one, at least in my line of work, is really SQL. You can't really go very far without knowing SQL. Fortunately, SQL is a fairly simple language, so I would never hold it against a candidate that they are not experts in SQL, because I think anyone can learn. But having that baseline is important, and having also a very good understanding of statistics, I think, is crucial. And by that, I don't mean to know every distribution and every statistical test under the earth. I mean to understand a few statistical concepts and understand them very, very well. Because people will come up with edge cases and this and that, that unless you're very well steeped into your statistics, you will not be able to answer.
Gotcha. That's very interesting. I want to get back to that in a second, but before, I want to comment on what you said about it's not about the skills. And I totally agree with that. Like, for instance, even when we're hiring at Super Data Science, we not as much look at what the person can do in terms of how experienced they are or what skills they have. Like, personally, I look for passion. I look for drive. I look for like purpose, meaning. I look for people who are like eager, who can't sit still. They want to know everything. And even before you've spoken to them, they already know everything about your company. They already have looked everywhere. They know what they can improve. They come with value add propositions and so on. And those are the people that add value to the bottom line. And I think it's just I wanted to comment on on your point that it's not only about the skills. Yeah. In fact, it's less about the skills than it's about the type of person you are.
Yeah, I totally agree. In fact, there are a lot of skills that can be learned. And, you know, I spoke about SQL being an easy language. You know, if someone demonstrate that they have the ability to learn, they are very curious, and they want to learn, then I wouldn't hold against them that they are not expert in SQL, because I know that they will be able to master it, and there are things that are more important to me than their pure technical skills on programming language.
Yeah, totally agree. And speaking of statistics, can you give us a few concepts, like, I don't know, hypothesis testing, A-B testing, things that you think are important for a person to know, like just examples, and then our listeners can pick and choose from there what they would want to focus on. And why I'm asking is because I often, very often get this question. You know, data science is like people start understanding the skills and techniques and methodologies and tools in data science, but then they're still left with kind of this a bit of uncertainty that there's so much statistics out there. Which concepts should they focus on in order to, as you say, when they come into an organization, be well grounded and be able to stand their ground in terms of statistical discussions and presenting their findings and things like that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think you mentioned a few. So hypothesis testing is absolutely fundamental, and there are subtleties in, you know, hypothesis testing. It's not something that's very intuitive. In fact, it's not intuitive at all. And so mastering really the language and the logic behind a hypothesis testing is very important, in part because that's what people use to prove or disprove hypothesis. That's what people use to accept or reject an A-B test. So understanding that is very critical. Understanding also the key statistics that are used to accept or reject an A-B test, whether it's like a chi-square test or whether it's just like a t-test between two variables is important. One of the things that I think is also important is to understand the concept around the central limit theorem. The fact that when you have like individual events or individual users and you group them together, you always end up having some sort of a normal distribution. If you take, you know, let's say that we were looking at the average number of photo edited per cohort on VSCO. So let's, you know, we start like with the January cohort, the February cohort, the March cohort, and we just take the average of number edited per cohort, it'll obey a normal distribution. Even though people individually are not, certainly not, you know, editing photos on a normal distribution. If you just took like the distribution of the number of photo edited per person in a given month, that is an exponential distribution. You know, you have more people editing one than two than three than four. So it's like monotonous and it's decreasing. However, when you start taking averages, it always follow a normal distribution. So like this, being able to, you know, move in and out of this concept and understanding that, I think is actually pretty important because few people really understand that. Another thing is regression analysis. I think it's still pretty key. It's a simple tool, but it can be pretty powerful when you have a few high-powered features or predictors. So being able to correctly interpret regression analysis, knowing also the trade-off and the problems with regression analysis is important.
Awesome. So yeah, the limitations of linear and multiple linear regression. That's
yeah, different. Exactly.
Gotcha. That's been a great overview. So hypothesis testing and mastering the language and logic, A-B testing, key statistics used for this, so it's either a chi-square test or a t-test, central limit theorem, being able to jump in and out, understanding how things become normalized or become turned into normal distributions when you do certain statistical changes to them, and regression analysis. And I want to add one more, my favorite one, which I kind of like always hold dear to my heart, the law of large numbers. It's very basic, yeah, but you know, the more times you do something, the closer your average is going to be to the expected value. You gotta know that one.
Yeah, totally. I totally agree with that.
All right, Cool. Okay, so we kind of like, time flies with you, Ruben. Like, we're getting close to the end. I'm like, we need a third podcast. Where is this going? but I want to do a big shout out to you, to your hiring in Visco. Like, I think about 30 to 40%, I might be lying here, so I won't say the statistic, but a huge percentage of, speaking of statistics, huge percent of our listeners are in San Francisco, not just in California, but specifically in the San Francisco and Bay Area. And yeah, so guys, Visco is hiring, and I really don't, whether you have a job or you don't have a job already, like, get in touch with Ruben, and like, first come, first served. Ruben, you're going to probably get like bombarded.
No, I love the promotion. Thanks for the shout out.
Yeah. So what's the best way they can get in touch with you and see if this position is right for them?
I think they can check out on my LinkedIn. I have a link to the position itself.
Yeah.
I encourage really people to check it out, see whether it vibes with their interests, with their qualifications, and feel free to either send me a message or apply directly on the website. I guarantee that we look at every single resume, guaranteed. So it's not a black box. So either one of them works fine.
Awesome. Gotcha. And I'm just looking at your LinkedIn. If somebody's like listening to this in their car or something, they're easy to remember. bit.ly/VSCO, that's Visco, and then small letters, data job. Visco data job, check it out. You definitely, like, if I was looking for a job, I'd love to work in a team. Like, I'm looking at some of your photos on the Visco LinkedIn page. You guys it looks like you have a really cool office, right? Is the corporate culture there pretty good?
Yeah, it's actually one of the most amazing company I've worked for.
Yeah.
It's actually really incredible. It's a bunch of very smart but very humble people that are extremely collaborative. And so it's never about who did what and who forgot to do what and who takes credit for a particular project. It's always, let's solve this as a team. If anyone sees any bug or any problem, that person will immediately signal it to the rest of the team, and everybody will work to solve it. When there's a big achievement, the entire team is recognized, not just the one person who drove the project. It's a very relaxed but also very accountable environment. People know the job that they have to do, and they do it, and because they know that other people rely on them, not because their boss asked them to do it. So I really love it for that. In fact, it's a very flat organization. Someday you might be working with the CEO on a project, and another day you might be pulled in a team with a couple engineers and product managers working on it. It really doesn't matter who's in the room and who asks to do it. You everybody will perform the same.
Fantastic. And whoever gets this job or jobs, like, I got an idea. Let me know that you applied from the podcast and you got the position. And then when I'm next time in San Francisco, you, Ruben, and I will all go out for dinner and have a fun chat about how all of this happened and came to be.
Absolutely. Dinner on me.
Okay. Deal. So thanks a lot for coming on the podcast once again and sharing all of this overwhelm of knowledge. Yeah. Incredible.
Thanks for having me again. It was, again, a pleasure to talk to you and to your listeners.
So there you have it. I hope you enjoyed today's session. Lots and lots of valuable information. So diverse, right? We talked about so many different things. We talked about the three points that Ruben focused on when he came into the organization. Ruben actually gave us a case study breakdown of how he went about analyzing a project and answering questions and actually posing the right questions to answer in the first place. I think that was a very valuable example. Then we talked about the statistical concepts that Ruben is looking for in his ideal candidate, and I think that was very valuable. And I'm kind of even torn between the two. What is the most valuable for me? The example that he gave of the case study, where there's these two types of ways you could pose the question, or the statistical breakdown. I think I'll lean towards, they both have merit, but I'll probably lean towards the statistical concepts that he outlined, and that is very valuable, just having that summary of the five statistical points that you guys have been asking me for so many times, like, what do you learn in statistics? Well, there you go. We've outlined them in the podcast. You can always reference these when you're researching statistics for your career. And speaking of careers, don't forget that Ruben is hiring, so definitely check out his link. You can get all of the links and show notes at www.superdatascience.com/39, and there you'll see the link to the job he's posted. I don't think he'll be up for long, especially with this podcast coming out. You know, thousands of people listen to it per day, or especially in the first few days. So jump on it early, get in touch with Ruben, and I look forward to all of us catching up and having dinner together in San Francisco when I'm there next time. So make sure you get that job, and I'll see you there soon. And thank you so much for being on this show. I really appreciate you spending an hour with us today, and I can't wait to see you next time. Until then, happy analyzing.